contents of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And our first story today is entitled, The Literary Ecosystem is Dying. And this was written by Adam Kirsch. With this week's announcement of massive cuts at the Washington Post, the paper's Book World supplement earned a dismal distinction. It may be the only newspaper book review section to have been killed twice. The first time was in 2009 when papers across the country were slashing books coverage in an attempt to stave off budgetary apocalypse. So when the Post relaunched Book World in 2022, readers and writers reacted with the same mixture of amazement and trepidation inspired by the dinosaurs at Jurassic Park. The rebirth of a dead species was wonderful to see, but how would it end? Now we know. The new Book World was just as good as the old Book World. The editors and critics who lost their jobs this week, including John Williams, Ron Charles, and Becca Rothfeld, followed in the tradition of Jonathan Yardley and Michael Dearda, the post-Pulitzer Prize-winning stalwarts. But quality had nothing to do with the decision to cut book reviews, just as it had nothing to do with cuts in the paper's sports and international coverage. Rather, the Post was making the same business decision that most other publications have made. People don't want to read book reviews, at least not enough people to make publishing them worthwhile. It's a vicious circle. As people feel less of a need to keep up with new books, they stop reading reviews. Publications respond by cutting books' coverage, so readers don't hear about new books. As a result, they buy fewer books, which makes publications think they're not worth covering. As someone who has been writing book reviews for decades, including as a staff critic for several publications, this is a bitter pill to swallow. It's tempting to react by blaming the decline of literature, of literacy, of society itself. And there's plenty of evidence that those things are, in fact, declining. But the disappearance of the book review does not mean the end of criticism or of critics. There are still many places to read smart, insightful writing about books, starting with The Atlantic, of course. There are venerable magazines such as The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, and Harper's, and newer ones such as The Metropolitan Review and The Point. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal still have excellent weekly book sections. And there's an embarrassment of riches on Substack, though you have to know where to look. If you tried to keep up with all of the good criticism out there, you'd have no time left for reading actual books. There is also no shortage of enthusiasm for talking about books. Just look at Book Talk, Goodreads, Reddit, Amazon, or anywhere else people gather online to react, share, rank, and ask questions about the books they love or hate. Even 4chan, the notorious message board, has become a home for literary omnivores and autodidactics. Many of these readers don't think book reviewers deserve to be mourned any more than any other kind of, quote, gatekeepers, end quote. If people no longer trust experts to tell them what vaccines to take or what stocks to buy, why do they need book critics to tell them what to read? In a sense, the decline of book reviews, like the decline of newspapers themselves, is a story about disaggregation. Newspapers used to bundle several functions together in a way that made them both useful and profitable. A daily chunk of newsprint told you about the world and local events, but also about stock prices, movie showings, potential romantic partners, and where to buy washing machines on sale. When the Internet made finding that information easy and free, many people decided against paying for just the news part of the newspaper. Similarly, book reviews used to play a number of roles in the literary ecosystem. In addition to informing readers about newly published books, they offered analysis to learn from, opinions to argue with, and, at their best, good writing to enjoy. Certain critics, such as John Leonard and Elizabeth Hardwick, were usually better stylists than the writers they were reviewing. All of these functions are now served in different ways online or by different kinds of publications. But as with the newspaper, the whole was more than the sum of its parts. The most important thing that a daily book critic or a weekly book supplement does is bring a literary community into being. The kind of community that exists when people who don't know one another are all thinking about the same thing at the same time. Concentrated attention is indispensable for civic well-being and meaningful political debate. It is just as important for literary life, maybe even more important because people who take an interest in books are fewer in number and need more help finding one another. A book critic or a newspaper book section is a convener, bringing people together around a new book or writer, a literary trend, or controversy. This agenda setting is, of course, a kind of gatekeeping. Not every book can be reviewed, much less praised. That's why one of the responsibilities of a good critic or editor is to have a broad definition of what matters and what's interesting. When such critics and editors disappear, every part of the literary ecosystem suffers. Readers don't discover new writers and new kinds of writing they might love. Publishers find it harder to connect with audiences, so they publish fewer and less adventurous books. Writers don't get the public feedback they need to develop their talents, even if they don't always like getting it. And, of course, the odd characters who actually enjoy writing reviews find it harder to make a living. This week, more than ever. Our next story, the mysterious devices speeding mining exploration in Utah, written by Lauren Steele. Bushwhacking through a stand of stunted aspens above 10,000 feet in Utah's Tushar Mountain Range, the mountain guide Trevor Katz held his Garmin to the sky and pointed it south. "We should just look for an opening," he said, glancing over at his colleague Bailey Pugh, from under a ball cap he'd cut into a visor. He took a few steps steeply downhill, then down. Uphill, careful not to slide on the scree. "It says it's right below us, probably 10 meters. Wait, 5. Wading through the walls of branches, he and Pugh circled, eyes trained on the ground. Then, there it was, stuck in the dirt. The hexagonal silver node looked like a device an alien could have planted. Its small antenna and carrying strap sat above the earth. A sharp spike below anchored it into the slope. It would be a strange thing to stumble upon this so high in the mountains, surrounded only by what can survive at such an elevation. This is just one of 200 nodes planted across the range in a tidy grid, each tracked with a GPS waypoint. Earlier, they had placed the nodes in the ground. Now it was time to extract them. Pugh hoisted this one out of the ground and into her pack. Then it was back to bushwhacking. "This is why they had to hire mountain guides," Pugh told me, as we picked up our steps carefully across the boulders. At the beginning of the summer, Katz and Pugh had received an email from the owner of a guiding company they'd worked for in the past. A client needed mountain-savvy day workers for a new project. Any interest? The biggest hint they got about the purpose of the project was that the field's crew's meeting place, the Deer Trail Mine at the mountain's eastern base. Each team was given a set of GPS waypoints and told to take a 20-pound node, about as big as a football, to each location, plant it in the ground, and mark its location. It was really mysterious, Levi War, another crew member, told me, but the pay was good, $500 a day, plus a per diem, as much as they usually earn for a few days of guiding. And the instructions were clear enough, so out they went. Only as the summer went on did the crew come to understand, from chatting with the project geologists and fieldwork managers, what exactly they were doing. Helping locate some of the nation's most in-demand, mineable resources across a patchwork of public and private lands, arranged in grids that connect to low-Earth orbit satellites, the nodes are capable of collecting and sharing data, used to create high-resolution maps of anomalies miles underground that might be gold, copper, nickel, lithium, or other minerals. The nodes used in the project were first released 3 years ago by the Australian company Fleet Space Technologies, and although they've been adopted by mining giants internationally, how widely they're being used in the United States is unclear. Compared with older and more invasive survey methods, this technology can be deployed with minimal impact. According to Fleet Space, it can be particularly useful for surveying areas where permits are required. For the Fish Lake National Forest, for example, and the Bureau of Land Management Territory, enveloping the Tushar Mountains. If this quiet method of mineral exploration is successful, it will have threaded a loophole in the law governing public lands, helping open them for mining that much more quickly and controversially. All it will take is a few hundred nodes, a clear view of the sky to connect to satellites, and a small team of people who know how to traverse rough terrain. Historically, mining exploration projects had depended on a giant boom, drop hammers, trucks with vibrating base plates, and dynamite blasts send seismic waves through the Earth's subsurface to a grid of geophones. The waves' travel times are translated into rough maps of mineralized zones. On U.S. public lands, taking even this first step toward a new mine means getting approval, whether from the Forest Service or the BLM, a process that can be stringent and slow, requiring data collection and environmental assessment. Instead of shakes and booms, Fleet Space's node system relies on the naturally occurring vibrations of the Earth and the sound waves created by those walking upon it. These scraps of seismic data from everyday life are gathered by the node's internal geophones. After collection, the data are processed into ambient noise tomography, or ANT, surveys, which provide the highest level of detail of what is underground, compared with traditional methods. The American West has long led the country in producing gold, copper, coal, and silver, as well as rare, sought-after elements such as beryllium, that can be used for aerospace and defense technologies. The unique geologic profiles here, the Colorado Plateau, the Basin and Range region, the Rocky Mountains, are side effects of ancient inland seas, volcanic history, and an active boundary between two tectonic plates. Billions of years of pressure, folding, and depositing created a region rich with minerals, just close enough to the surface to mine. In the 1860s, white settlers flocked to what would become Marysvale, where the Deer Trail Mine is now located, with high hopes to strike gold, silver, and copper. By the 1930s, though, most of the mines had closed. The shallower, more accessible resources had been tapped, and it was too expensive to keep trying to get rich. Over the years, a series of companies have bought the Deer Trail Mine in failed attempts to revive it. Helen and Alan Johnson told me. They're lifelong residents of Marysvale and former employees of the mine, and they agreed to meet me at a Mexican restaurant in Orem, Utah, to talk history. Most recently, in 2018, MAG Silver, a Canadian company, bought the mine. The new owners had started exploring national forest land for silver, gold, and copper with more traditional methods before turning to the fleet-space nodes for this summer's surveys. These minerals, plus others that Fleet Space nodes can help discover, including cobalt, nickel, and lithium, are all on the country's list of critical minerals. Demand for these materials is growing exponentially. Together and separately, they are used in iPhones, photovoltaic panels, combat drones, and many other technologies now key to Americans' quality of life or national security. Some materials, like diamonds, can be whipped up in labs, but these particular resources come only from the ground. Now, the right combination of technology and political timing could mean that whatever is still in Utah's mountains and elsewhere could be within reach for those who want it. As tariffs have kicked in and America seeks to ease its reliance on China for refined metals and minerals, the Trump administration has turned its attention to opening up U.S. land for mining, even when that means that the companies doing the mining aren't American ones. To plant one of the ANT nodes, Trevor Katz told me while walking up a slope scattered with juniper trees, does not require much. Hike in with a pickaxe, dig a hole a few inches deep, and place the sharp end of the node into that hole, making sure the spike containing the geophone is completely covered. To extract it, just pull it out of the ground and hike it out. He and Pugh did this over and over, often putting in dozens of miles a day, as the field crew placed and extracted 200 nodes four separate times, first for a regional survey that covered about 50 square miles across Bureau of Land Management territory, national forest, and land the mine already owns, then for three surveys, mostly on Forest Service land, that made a more detailed search for anomalies. To regulate mining activities on public land, balancing its responsibility to both conserve the land and make it useful, the Forest Service is supposed to consider the activity's surface disturbance. Exploration that's unlikely to cause significant disturbance can go forward, without the Forest Service involvement. This distinction has helped separate casual use of public lands, such as private citizens panning for gold, which anyone can do freely, from commercial activities. The surveys conducted last summer for the Deer Trail Mine Project didn't have any permits associated with them. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request for documentation of the ANT surveys, filed or on behalf of any of the stakeholders involved in the project, including MAG Silver and the Deer Trail Mine. None were filed with the BLM or the U.S. Forest Service. The companies involved in the project either did not respond to requests for comment or declined to comment for this article. The Fish Lake National Forest Ranger Station, which has long worked with Deer Trail Mine and is responsible for all permitting and communication regarding the company's mining activities on Forest Service land, told me that any commercial exploration at all would be expected to be disclosed to the rangers, but that the station had no knowledge of the ANT surveys. A spokesperson for the Forest Service National Press Office told me, however, that this type of survey does not need a permit or even a formal notice of intent, which the agency uses to determine whether further oversight is needed. But the legal experts I asked about the ANT nodes told me that they fall into a gray area of the law. The key term is significant disturbance, Elizabeth Craddock, a government relations attorney and a partner at Holland & Knight in Washington, D.C., who specializes in national Natural Resources told me. But the regulation itself doesn't define what significant means, she said. So what counts is up for interpretation. These commercial exploration projects seem to have found a way to quietly bypass federal regulations that outline how and when approval is given before exploration begins on public lands. If the Deer Trail Mine project is back into operation, it will need permits. This past fall, it was acquired as part of MAG Silver by another Canadian company, Pan American Silver, which has not pursued any further work on the project so far. But any next steps towards reopening a mine here could go faster than ever, too. Last March, President Trump signed an executive order directing federal agencies to expedite mining projects and prioritize mining activities on public lands. The administration has also made changes, at least temporarily, to the National Environmental Policy Act review process to accelerate project approvals. Agencies are no longer required to analyze long-term environmental effects that are hard to trace back to the initial cause, which significantly reduces the scope of every project's review. Opening up new mining operations would be in keeping with the founding directive of the Forest Service, which mandates the balance of protecting resources and extracting them. Many mines give small rural towns a needed economic boost, too. In Marysvale, for example, the median household income is $28,750 a year, and the unemployment rate is 63%. Still, while he's out retrieving the nodes that could make new mines a reality, Katz told me, he's been telling myself little copes that everybody does, that it'll be a long time before this land is developed. Looking out over the windswept tops of Mount Holly and the Llano Peak, into a valley meadow called Horse Heaven, and across the entire range, I imagined 800 empty holes where the nodes used to be. Katz had mentioned that the project's marketing materials clearly said that all the holes would be filled in, perhaps a gesture toward remediation plan for the survey's relatively small impacts, but that he and other guides had not, in fact, filled them in. These holes were nothing you'd see unless you were looking. It's likely that the first hard autumn rain quietly washed them away. But if this particular combination of technology and policy does add up to more mining across the country, the result will be loud and obvious. Our third story, The Intellectual Edgelords of the GOP, written by Laura K. Field. Calling the Trump administration fascist has become a cliché, but some federal departments seem keen on the comparison. Consider the administration's messaging on social media. The Department of Homeland Security's Facebook account recently posted a recruiting notice for ICE under the banner, "We Will Have Our Home Again," the title of a white nationalist anthem by the Pine Tree Riots. The Department of Labor recently posted a video montage referencing American battle scenes under the tagline, "One Homeland, One People, One Heritage, Remember Who You Are, American," a slogan close to the Nazi era, Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer. Many of these posts borrowed overtly from Christianity. In December, the DHS and White House accounts shared Christmas-themed posts celebrating mass deportations, and encouraging self-deportation. One featured video of armed agents performing night raids with a caption quoting Matthew 5:9 in black-letter type. There were signs from the start that the Trump-led GOP would reward transgression against liberal democratic norms. The reality is the transformation is the culmination of years of work by niche groups of conservative intellectuals who have long rejected America's liberal traditions and now dominate the halls of power. This call to arms scandalized many establishment conservatives, some of whom provided a check on Trump in his first term. Members of Trump's first cabinet prevented him from ratcheting up his trade war, fully alienating allies, deploying U.S. troops to American cities, and withdrawing them suddenly from overseas. In October of 2021, Heritage Foundation tapped Kevin Roberts, the former CEO of the Trump-friendly Texas Public Policy Foundation, to be its next president. This marked a change in orientation for one of Washington's most influential conservative think tanks. Today, elite MAGA world figures, including Anton and Peter Thiel, flirt openly with the idea of Caesarism, or a Red Caesar, whereby a lone authoritarian ruler might restore the country's strength. Post-liberals such as Patrick Deanan write about how regime change is possible only with a new elite, one that understands the value of Machiavellian means to achieve Aristotelian ends. The influential philosopher-blogger Curtis Yarvin has called for the total dismantling of the cathedral, by which he means the all-powerful liberal institutions at the center of modern life, which operate like a church in that they dictate how people should think. What unifies these thinkers is a totalizing and conspiratorial conception of modern liberal politics. In October, after Tucker Carlson hosted a young white nationalist influencer, Nick Fuentes, in a long and indulgent interview on his podcast, quite a few conservatives struggled to distance themselves from Fuentes without alienating other political allies. Roberts at the Heritage Foundation raised hackles when he initially defended Carlson. He then tried to split the difference by criticizing Fuentes, but not Carlson. Edgelordism has become the currency du jour in the GOP, from the Ivy League through the streets of Minnesota. The MAGA New Right seems to be betting that American polity has a deep reserve of untapped nativist rage, which can be harnessed in the service of their culture war against the liberal status quo. If current polls are to be believed, the administration seems to be underestimating the everyday decency and patriotism of the American right, of the American public, Boundary-pushing ideas can be invigorating, and opportunities to question and resist received wisdom are essential to any free and democratic society. But the pursuit of transgression for its own sake can easily derail sound judgment. The risk is in presuming that anything subversive or sensational is also true and meaningful, and that anything conventional is a lie that must be smashed down. That is a brutal way to inhabit the world, and, I hope, a losing one. That last article had to be shortened due to time constraints, because we have run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the National North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.